through with love, and I'll have nothing more to do with love. I stay away, but every day I'm just fooling myself. I tell my friends that I don't care. I shrug my shoulders at the whole affair, but they all know it isn't so. I'm just fooling myself. And every time I pass and see myself in my looking glass, I turn my face and say, how do, you fool? You've thrown your life away. I'm nonchalant and acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I may pretend, but in the end, I'm just fooling myself.
Hey, it's April Fool's Day, and last week, Mother Nature played an April Fool's trick on us. So much of the snow had melted, I fooled myself into thinking we might make it through March without a blizzard. But, haha, 8+ inches of the world totally changed in a single day. Even the Subaru never gets stuck. The Subaru actually got stuck in the driveway. And I tell myself, now things are going to go back to normal, right? Stay tuned.
And every time I pass and see myself in my looking glass, I turn my face and say, how do, you fool? You've thrown your life away. I'm nonchalant and acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I may pretend, but in the
that's Diane Schur with the Mose Allison tune. I'm Michael Goldberg, and today on Stay Human, a salute to the trickster, the heroes, or the villains, depending on where you sit, who ignore all the boundaries of proper behavior, always step over the line. Subversives is what they are, violating the rules of society and of what everyone agrees to call common sense. In mythology, the trickster disrupts the existing order and replaces it, even if only temporarily, with a new way of doing. The Greek Hermes is the patron of thieves. He invented lying. Ishu in Yoruban myth, Jacob of the Old Testament, Anansi in Loki. Loki, from the Norse mythology, crossed the boundary between human and animal, changing at will into a bird or a mare. He crossed the gender boundary, too, giving birth to a foal. Just messing with us, turning everything upside down. On today's program, we'll have several different kinds of trickster stories, tricksters of legend, tricksters from popular culture, and tricksters active today walking among us, laftivists who think a social revolution just might be fueled by laughter. We start our program with a traditional tale from storyteller Sue Searing.
One of my favorite characters in folklore is Nasiruddin. He's known across the Islamic world by various names, when there are literally thousands of jokes and stories about him. He's a mullah, a learned man, but he's also a fool. He's not a trickster in the mythic sense, not someone who, say, steals fire from the gods, but he is a prankster, and he is known for speaking truth to power. This is one of my favorite stories about Nasiruddin. One day, he was working in his garden out on the edge of town. He worked hard all day, and by the end of the day he was dirty and sweaty and didn't smell that good. Finally, he laid down his shovel and began walking home. And as he was passing through town, he went by the Shah's palace. The gate stood open, and noble people dressed in their finest clothes were entering the palace grounds. And then he sniffed, and he could smell wonderful aromas of food cooking coming out from the kitchen windows. "Aha," he said, "the Shah is giving a banquet." And then he realized how hungry he was after working hard in his garden all day. And even though he was dirty and sweaty, he walked right up to the palace guards and presented himself. "Well, there is a command in Islam to feed the hungry and to welcome the stranger, and so the guards had to let him in. But they took him into that great big banquet hall and hustled him off into the far corner at the end of a long table. Well, Nasiruddin could have been insulted, but he was just anticipating the great meal he was going to have. And soon all of the guests were seated, the Shah and his special guests of honor at the head of the banquet hall, and the servants came in with great platters heaped with food. They went up to the head table and served the dignitaries and then began working their way back down those long tables. And when they got to the corner where Nasiruddin sat, the platters were empty. "Oh, well," he sighed, "there's bound to be another course." And sure enough, before long, the servants came in again with more platters piled high with delicacies, and they began at the head of the hall, working their way back, and when they got to Nasiruddin, the platters were empty. Well, he could see that this was going to be the same with every course, so he left by a back door. But instead of going home, he just went around the corner where his friend lived, his rich friend. And he asked him, "Could I borrow some clothes?" "Oh, certainly, certainly, Mullah," said his friend. "I will lend you some clothes, and you know, you are a bit dirty. Why don't you have a quick bath?" So Nasiruddin cleaned himself up, and then his friend gave him a beautiful coat made of fine fabrics and a lovely strip of fabric with gold embroidery in it to wind around his head for a turban, and a very well-made pair of sandals. And Nasiruddin walked back around the corner to the palace gates and presented himself. The guards did not recognize him as that filthy laborer that they had let in earlier. They took one look and assumed he was the last guest to arrive, the prince from a far country who must have been delayed. And they escorted him into the banquet hall right up to the head table, where there was a vacant chair. As soon as Nasiruddin sat down, servants appeared, laying platters and plates and bowls in front of him. And then he took the sleeve of his jacket, and he began to dip it up and down in the gravy. He took the rolls off the platter and began stuffing them down the front of his shirt. He grabbed a bowl of salad and dumped it in his lap. By now, conversation had stopped in the banquet hall. Everyone was looking at this unknown prince at the head table. And the Shah said, "Sir, is this how you behave at banquets in your country?" "Oh, no, no," said Mullah Nasiruddin as he drizzled some juice over his shoulders. "No, not at all. But you see, it's these clothes that got me in here. It is only right and proper that they should have the first taste of everything."
Thanks to Sue Searing for that story.
"Have a banana, Anna. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste the bologna, Tony. Everybody eats house when you come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake, having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hannah, Dee Dee, Tommy, Dora, Andre. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Pasta Fazula, Tallulah. Oh, do have a bagel, bagel. Now don't be so bashful, Nashville. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Hey, this is a party, Marty. There, you get the cherry, Jerry. Now look, don't be so picky, Mickey. Cause everybody eats when they come to my house. All of my friends are welcome. Don't make me coax you, moax you. Eat the tables, the chairs, the napkins, who cares? You gotta eat if it chokes you. Oh, do have a knish, knishya. Ask him the latke, matke. Chili con carne for Barney. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Face, Buster, Cher, Chops, Fump. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
I think my favorite trickster hero of all time has to be Harpo Marx. He loved to party, even as a grade school dropout, hustling the streets of the Bronx, always on the lookout for the quick chance, whatever was free for the taking. He broke all the rules like they weren't even there, and he went on doing it his whole life long. Once he became a star of Broadway and Hollywood, he really lived it up. Hung with a coterie of writers and actors, many of them famous from the Algonquin Round Table. Oh yeah, Harpo could talk, and he didn't always care what he said. One time, he was at a summer retreat with other celebrities on an island in upstate New York where one of them had a camp, their private playground. But their privacy was invaded by people staring at them from the shore and even rowing out to the island to get a look at the movie stars. Harpo persuaded a few of his fellows to join him. They stripped off their clothes, painted their bodies blue, and he had an extra couple of fright wigs along, too, that he could give his buddies. And then they came charging out of the woods, acting like Hollywood savages, screaming and shouting and scaring away the sightseers. I'd love to see what he would have done to modern-day paparazzi. Harpo's character on screen is the most gorgeous, perfect trickster I've ever seen. He violated every rule of decorum and sowed chaos wherever he went. Being mute, he crossed the boundary between man and animal and the boundary between man and angel. His is the perfect dance of the free spirit, and anyone, not just his audiences of 80 years ago, and not just people who've grown up on American movies, any human anywhere in the world will immediately understand and laugh at his glorious clown, because lurking in the heart of all of us, there's this secret suspicion that the way the world is ordered is arbitrary and absurd. And this secret wish to suddenly, finally leap up on the banquet table in front of all the horrified stuffed shirts, grab everything you can, throw it in your pockets, and then run like hell. It's the trickster spirit. And it's alive in all of us, maybe deep, deep down. Maybe I'm wrong about this, but I don't think so. All of us got a little bit of that trickster.
Thank you.
Music by Nino Rota. Our professor of pop culture, Jack Nachbar, knows a thing or two about tricksters, and he offers us this.
We straighten up in our seats and cheer them on. Newman and Redford bamboozle Robert Shaw again, and then again in the sting. Charlie Chaplin sticks out his cane, and another big, clumsy chump bites the dust. Cool Steve McQueen shows dazzling Faye Dunaway that Flim Flam is even more fun than romance in the Thomas Crown Affair. Movie tricksters. They lie, they cheat, they steal, and leave their victims a little wiser and a lot sadder. And we love them. Our consciences tell us we should hate them, but we love them. We always have. They show us the absurdity of and teach us to laugh at pretentiousness of all kinds, be it wealth, social status, or simply size. My favorite movie tricksters are cartoon characters. They're the American cultural tradition of animal tricksters. Some have origins thousands of years old. African Americans have Brer Rabbit, Native Americans have Coyote and Raven. All of us have Bugs, Jerry, and Foghorn Leghorn. These fabulous chaos makers range from the passive-aggressive, like the annoying little Tweety Bird and the supersonic Roadrunner, to the overtly aggressive, like that master of mischief, Speedy Gonzales. Bugs and Jerry are our two greatest tricksters, however. Both of them were born in 1940, just as Herr Hitler was playing his infinitely more tragic and deadly tricks. Elmer Fudd, in A Wild Hare, was hunting wabbits, and a smart alecky wabbit popped out of his hole and said, "What's up, Doc?" with a Brooklyn accent. He proceeded to reduce poor Elmer to tears. Bugs was off and running, chomping carrots along the way, using wile and guile to humiliate his dim-witted opponents. Fudd was constantly befuddled, and the short, loudmouthed Yosemite Sam usually ended with a burnt-off mustache. People adored the cocky varmint. By 1942, Bugs was the most popular of all the great cartoon characters at Warner Brothers. For the next 22 years, the fuzzy-tailed critter ruled. He won an Oscar. His cartoon, What's Opera Doc, in 1957, was named the greatest cartoon of all time and has been inducted into the Library of Congress National Film Registry. Bugs has his own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He was the first cartoon character to appear on a postage stamp. All in all, pretty good for a fella who lives down a hole. Bugs was known for Smout Marth. Bugs was known for his Bugs was known for his smart mouth. Jerry Mouse never talked at all. But with his beaten and bruised victim, Tom Cat, Jerry became a gold mine for MGM and the most popular cartoon character of all time. Before they finished their run in 1958, Tom and Jerry had made 114 tunes and earned 7 Oscars. The series was famous for its uninhibited violence. The story was always the same. Big Cat bugs Little Mouse. Then the imaginative and pugnacious rodent tortures the cat into near madness with a series of wildly destructive gags. We laugh at the imagination of the mayhem. Jerry strains Tom through a tennis racket or slingshots him onto a hot stove. In one tune, Jerry decapitates Tom. In another, he electrocutes him. We never feel sorry for Tom. He's a bully and deserves Jerry's trickster tortures. Besides, we know Tom will always recover and come back for more. There were minor cartoon tricksters, too. The crow constantly chiseled the fox. Disney's tricksters, the busy little chipmunks Chip and Dale, in more than 20 cartoons, drove Donald Duck into bouts of white-hot, babbling rage. Trickster tunes at the movies died in the 1960s, but they still live happily in endless revivals on TV. And TV carries on the tradition with new material. Nickelodeon's Ren and Stimpy show from the early 1990s featured a stupid cat, Stimpy, victimized in various nefarious ways by aggressive little Chihuahua Ren. My favorite TV trickster tune is a parody of Tom and Jerry. The Itchy and Scratchy Show is a cartoon within a cartoon that has been a short feature for years on The Simpsons. There's no plot. Itchy, a sadistic blue mouse, simply destroys ugly cat Scratchy in two-minute ultra-gory episodes. Scratchy is nailed to the floor, filled with TNT, and blown to pieces. And that's one of the tamer moments. Blood is everywhere. Simpson kids, Bart and Lisa, sit glued to the TV, screaming with laughter. Me too. The real trickster here is Matt Groening, the creator of The Simpsons. The rascal has tricked me into laughing at vulgar hyper-violence unacceptable by any common standards of decency. Groening makes me more aware of the hypocrisy of those very standards, and I love it. As usual, the trickster has done his job.
That's all, folks.
And that ain't all, folks. Jack Nachbar will be back on this program in the weeks ahead with a close look, a second and a third look at the movies on Stay Human.
Way old Auntie Rooney Mo.
Sam Gaylord and his Peruvians. You're tuned to your Northern Community Radio Service, KAXE-KBXE. We broadcast nationally produced programs and local ones, many of them like this one, produced by volunteers, reflecting the people and cultures of northern Minnesota. We receive support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we're grateful to the listener members whose contributions keep us on the air and in the cloud at kaxe.org. That's Leon Russell's Roll Away the Stone. This Easter season, the news has been dominated by the March for Our Lives, the sudden mass movement led by people too young to vote, who intend to turn upside down the idea that nothing can be done, the law is the law, violence must be met with violence. Every time there is a mass shooting, the NRA and the politicians who parrot them say, more guns are the answer, we have to be safe. The student activists have come under all kinds of verbal attacks, including the observation that all of those marchers really were just paid stooges paid by liberal Democrats to go to the rally. When a reporter expressed surprise at this idea, the woman says, oh yeah, it's no secret, it's all over the internet. Yeah. It's no secret. It's all over the internet. These people vote, and they're heavily armed to boot, so I guess I shouldn't be laughing. Coming up next, we have a trickster story from those brilliant practitioners of the hoax, the Yes Men. Over the past 20 years almost, the Yes Men, a couple of troublemakers, have infiltrated conferences and assemblies of the smug, all kinds of gatherings of powerful people. They've impersonated Halliburton executives. They've impersonated public relations men for foreign dictators, economists proving the effectiveness and the need for modern-day slavery. You should check them out, the Yes Men. They even run a Yes Camp for troublemakers to get together and cook up new ways to disrupt things. Shortly after the mass shooting in Orlando last year, they invented and promoted a new public service initiative of the NRA. They called it Share the Safety.
We decided to name our initiative Share the Safety. And for the past few weeks, we've created business cards, drafted press releases, and built our website.
You know, the website is basically a buy one, give one program, just like Tom's Shoes, but for weapons.
The gut does not play nice.
We even shot a Share the Safety promo video that was just absurd enough to feel like something the actual NRA might do.
These days, the most endangered species is the law-abiding American citizen, especially those living in poor urban centers.
For a moment, people look at it and they wonder if it really is the NRA.
Dumb laws keep the urban poor unable to acquire life-saving firearms. That's why we at the NRA are teaming up with Smith & Wesson to Share the Safety. When you purchase a limited edition line of Smith & Wesson handguns at sharethesafety.org, we will donate an appropriate firearm to an at-risk, low-income citizen in the urban center of your choice.
This was a perfectly reasonable extension of the argument for gun rights and gun safety. Share the safety. Buy one, give one. Every time you buy a gun, we'll give one to an unarmed victim of gun violence, young African Americans in America's ghettos. And because of Orlando, they said we'll also help to arm the homosexuals. They have a right to feel safe. When their story set the Twitterverse on fire and national news outlets started to inquire and try to figure out what was really going on, they issued a second press release, also on NRA letterhead, claiming that this whole Share the Safety idea was a dangerous hoax, completely untrue, and the last thing the NRA wanted to do was to arm poor black people. Because, you know, how can you be sure that that gun won't fall into the wrong hands?
Thank you.
give me a home where the buffalo roam, where the deer, the antelope play. Well, seldom is a herd a discouraging word. Skies are not cloudy all day.
David Amram and Odetta, At Home Around the World. Amram might not have been a trickster, but he sure knows how to cross the boundaries. I'm Michael Goldberg, today saluting the trickster spirit, and I've got a confession to make. I'm still under the spell of a character who was a hero to me when I was 5 years old.
Wonderful, wonderful cat. Whenever he gets in a fix, he reaches into his bag of tricks. Felix the cat, the wonderful, wonderful cat. You'll laugh so hard your sides will ache, your heart will go pitter-pat watching Felix the wonderful cat.
I didn't know it then, of course, lying on my stomach under the dining room table, eyes glued to that little black and white TV. But I was being indoctrinated, however subtly it might have been, indoctrinated into the belief that the little guy, if bold enough, could outwit the generals and the spies and the mad scientists who populated Cold War kids' TV. This little guy could draw a door anywhere he wanted and be bold enough to walk through it. As I look back now, it seems a straight line. Okay, maybe not so straight, a zigzagging line, but an unbroken one. From Felix the Cat at 5 to Frank Zappa when I was 15. Zappa the Trickster, with his musical parody and wild invention, his outrageous lyrics, and his disdain for groupthink. That early exposure to the mothers of invention, probably that's the main thing that kept me from playing it safe, from just pursuing a career or doing what my parents hoped I'd do. Never would have moved to the woods or thrown in 1978 with an extremely unlikely little idea called KAXE. I think that that exposure to Zappa, like worshiping Felix the Cat, forced me to keep pushing myself, try to cross the boundaries instead of finding my place in society. By now, of course, the edges are all worn smooth, and I am, by any measure, a solid citizen, a grown-up. Took an awful long time, though. The Tricksters were riding high in the 1960s. Ken Kesey's Merry Pranksters, the Beatles all dressed up as Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club. Abbie Hoffman and the Yippies disrupted the New York Stock Exchange by throwing dollar bills over the ledge of the visitors' gallery at the Stock Exchange. The video was hilarious in the meanest possible way. You could see the traders drop what they were doing, dance around trying to scoop up as many of the bills come floating through the air or fall to the floor. It was a perfect image of greed and excess, But of course, order was restored eventually, and the stock market went back to its business. No laughing matter. Coming up, I want to tell you a story about a contemporary trickster, one whose prank wasn't a passing bit of theater, but actually altered the course of events.
The way the environmental movement has been is like a football game, and our team is getting slaughtered. The refs have been paid off, and the other side is playing with dirty tricks. And so it's no longer acceptable for us to stay in the stands. It's time to rush the field. And it's time to stop the game.
That's Tim DeChristopher. In 2008, he wasn't a trickster yet. He was a student at the University of Utah, and like many people in Utah, he was very upset and trying to stop the Bureau of Land Management from holding an auction, auctioning off the oil and gas drilling rights on public lands, many parcels adjacent to the Canyonlands National Park and Arches National Park in Utah. Advocates had done all they could trying to protect this wilderness, trying to stop the sale. They even went to court over it. But there was nothing they could do. The auction went ahead as planned. A protest rally was held outside, and this one person, Tim DeChristopher, decided on impulse to leave the area where people were gathering to rally and instead to walk into the building. He had no particular plan at that point. He just wanted to see what he could see.
I've 2 1/4 in the back and not a 2 1/2. 2 1/2 to 2. Thank you, I have 3 1/2.
They said, "Why are you here for the auction?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And they said, "Are you here to be a bidder?" And I said, "Well, yes, I am."
So $50 to bidder number 7.
Well, he was officially a bidder, and he had a paddle. He started driving up the prices, competing with the most determined bidders. He drove one parcel up to $240 per acre, and he got into the rhythm of the thing. When about half the parcels were sold, he decided that he didn't want to see anybody else win a bid. He placed the winning bid on most of the rest, and bidder number 70 was starting to control a whole lot of oil rights until somebody figured out that he was an imposter. Well, the auction was thrown into chaos because he had inflated the price on so many of the parcels and claimed so many of the others. The auction, which had been preceded, remember, by months of controversy, public rallies, a lawsuit, this auction suddenly had to be shut down. Now, this was on December 18th, 2008, and there's a rule with these public auctions that they have to be announced at least 30 days in advance. So that meant to reschedule the auction, they had to slate it for the first month of the new administration. And in January 2009, President Obama's new Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar, dismissed the auction, saying that the Bureau of Land Management, eager to sell off all the oil and gas rights, had cut corners and had violated its own rules. And that auction never took place. Right now, anybody who goes out to Arches National Park, whether what you see is wasted money by all that oil and gas that hasn't been taken out of the ground, or whether you can hear the wilderness speaking to you, you ought to know the name Tim DeChristopher. And he paid the price. Bill Moyers interviewed him and asked, when did you know for sure that you would go to prison?
During the jury selection of the trial. That was what really did it. There was a moment during the jury selection, we had this huge jury pool because it was a high-profile case. And there was a moment where the prosecution and the judge found out that most of that jury pool had gotten a pamphlet before they came in on the first day from the Fully Informed Jurors Association. And it was a pamphlet that didn't say anything about my case, but it talked about juries' rights. It talked about why we have juries, and it, you know, quoted the founders of the country on juries being the conscience of the community. And the prosecution flipped out over this. It was the only time I saw the prosecutor completely lose his cool during the whole process. Mm-hmm. And we went into the judge's chambers, and the prosecutor was screaming and saying, we should have a mistrial here, and wanted to just throw the whole thing out.
Because of this pamphlet that we're...
Right. I mean, the prosecutor was almost spitting when he was reading from this and saying, this notion of voting your conscience, it's out in space. And and he was terrified. He was really scared. Of of what was on that pamphlet. And then rather than get rid of the whole jury pool, the judge called the jurors in one at a time to his chambers. And I was...
Each one, individually, yeah, privately.
Yeah. And my legal team and I were on one side of the table. The prosecution was on the other side. The judge was at the head of the table. And there was one juror at a time at the other end. And the judge would say, you understand it's not your job to decide what's right or wrong here. Your job is to listen to what I say the law says, and you have to enforce it even if you think it's morally wrong. Can you do that? Can you follow my instructions even if you think they're morally wrong? And unless they said yes, they weren't on the jury. And I was sitting in the seat closest to the juror, and I watched one person after another say, yes, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, even if I think it's morally wrong. And they meant it. And that's when I knew that I was going to be convicted.
Because they were going to decide if the law had been broken, not if it was a good law.
Yeah, yeah. And the judge would define for them what the boundaries of that law was. And, you know, so basically it was, if he committed this action, then he's guilty and you have to convict him. That to me was a huge turning point, because I saw two things in that situation where the judge was telling people that they had to let go of their own moral authority. You know, I saw how willing people were to let go of their moral authority, but at the same time, I saw the vulnerability of the prosecutor. And, you know, he's the U.S. attorney. He's the United States attorney. He represents the United States of America. He's got the whole power of the United States government behind him, and he was terrified. He felt vulnerable to the notion of citizens using their conscience in exercising their civic duties.
Tim DeChristopher, one of the most accomplished tricksters of modern day history. He had been offered plea bargains. Nobody's ever done time for failure to pay up on an auction bid. But he insisted on that jury trial, and as a result, did 21 months in a federal penitentiary. But he is unrepentant. He's out of prison now, and he's determined to continue to be a free person, building for a radical shift in society. He's active in all kinds of environmental work, and he's also now attending Harvard Divinity School, a decision he says first occurred to him when he was listening to those jurors agree to follow the judge's directions. He believes things could be different. Here he is at a rally shortly after his release from prison.
They tried to convince me that I was like a little finger out there on my own that could easily be broken. And all of you out here were the reminder for all of us that I wasn't just a finger all alone in there, but that I was connected to a hand with many fingers that could unite as one fist. And that fist cannot be broken by the power that they have in there. That fist is not a symbol of violence. That fist is a symbol that we will not be misled into thinking we are alone. We will not be lied to and told we are weak. Right. We will not be divided, and we will not back down. Right. That fist is a symbol that we are connected and that we are powerful. It's a symbol that we hold true to our vision of a healthy and just world, and we are building the self-empowering movement to make it happen.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the robe and crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, brothers, let's go down, come on down. Come on, brothers, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, fathers, let's go down, let's go down.
the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sinners, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sinners, let's go down, down in the river to pray. As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear
Rodrigo y Gabriela, thanks to our in-house musicologist, Gail Otteson, for choosing that piece. And thanks to Jack Nachbar and Sue Searing for being part of the show today. And to everyone who's ready to turn the tables, jump the fence, when that's what you gotta do to stay human.
This land is your land.